The country changed with dramatic suddenness as they emerged from the wastes of Bushmanland into the gently wooded, more benevolent Kavango area. Along the undulating ridges of the ancient compacted dunes grew tall trees, Combretum, the lovely bush willow, and Albizia, with its fine feathery foliage, and stands of young Mopane between them. The shallow valleys were covered with fine desert grasses, whose silver and pink seed heads brushed their stirrups arms as they rode through. The water was not far below the surface here, and all nature seemed to respond to its presence. For the first time since leaving the mission at Kelkrand, they saw large game, zebra and red golden impala, and they knew that the waterhole for which they were riding could be only a few miles ahead, for these animals would drink daily. It was not too soon, for all the horses were used up and weak, struggling onwards beneath the weight of their riders. A few inches remained in the water bottles, seeming to mock their thirst with hollow gurgles at each pace. Lothar de la Rey could not remain in the saddle unaided. Svart Hendrik rode on one side of him, and his bastard son Kleinboy on the other. They supported him when sudden bouts of delirium overcame him, and he laughed and ranted, and would have slipped from the saddle and tumbled to earth. Manfred trailed behind them, watching his father anxiously, but too exhausted and thirsty to assist him. They struggled up another rise in the endless succession of consolidated dunes, and Svart Hendrik stood in the stirrups and peered down into the gentle basin ahead of them, barely daring to hope that they had been able to ride directly to their destination through the trackless land, where every vista mirrored the previous one and the one that followed. All they had to steer by was the sun and the instinct of the desert creature. Then his spirits soared, for ahead of them there were the tall grey Mopane trunks nurtured into giants by the water over which they stood, and the four great umbrella acacia exactly as they had been imprinted in his memory. Between their trunks, Hendrik caught the soft sheen of standing water. The horses managed a last jolting trot down the slope and through the trees, then out over the bare clay that surrounded the shrunken puddle of water in the centre. The water was the colour of café au lait, not 10 paces across at the widest point, nor deeper than a man's knee. Around it, the hoof prints and pad marks of dozens of various types of wild animals, from the tiny multiple V-scratches of quail and francolin, to the huge round prints of a bull elephant the size of dustbin lids. They had been sculpted into the black clay and then baked by the sun, as hard as concrete. Hendrik and Kleinboy drove their mounts into the centre of the pool and then flung themselves face down into the lukewarm, muddy water, snorting and gasping and laughing wildly as they scooped it into their mouths. Manfred helped his father to dismount at the edge and then ran to scoop a hatful and bring it to Lothar, where he had collapsed into a sitting position, supporting himself on his own knees. Lothar drank greedily, choking and coughing as the water went down the wrong way. His face was blushed and swollen, his eyes fever bright, and the poison in his blood burning him up. Svart Hendrik waded to the side, his boots squelching and water pouring from his sodden clothing, still grinning, until a thought struck him, and he stopped. The grin was gone from his thick black lips, and he glared about him. "Nobody here," he grunted. "Buffalo and legs, where are they?" He broke into a run, spraying water at each pace, as he headed for the primitive hut that stood in the shade of the nearest umbrella acacia. It was empty and derelict. The charcoal of the campfire was scattered widely. The freshest signs were days, no, weeks old. He raged through the forest and at last came back to Lothar. Between them, Kleinboy and Manfred had helped Lothar into the shade, and he lay back against the trunk of the acacia. "They've deserted," Lothar anticipated Hendrik's report. "I should have known. 10 horses, worth £50 each. It was too much temptation." The rest and the water seemed to have strengthened him. He was lucid again. "They must have run away within days of us leaving them." Hendrik sank down beside him. "Surely they have taken the horses and sold them to the Portuguese, then gone home to their wives. Promise me that when you see them again, you will kill them slowly, Hendrik. Very slowly." "I dream of how I will do it," Hendrik whispered. "First, I will make them eat their own manhoods. I will cut them off with a blunt knife, and I will feed them to them in small pieces." They were both silent, staring at the small group of their 4 horses, which stood at the pool's edge. Their bellies were distended with water, but their heads were hanging pathetically, noses almost touching the baked clay. 70 miles to the river. 70 miles at least. Lothar broke the silence, and he began to unwrap the filthy rags that covered his arm. The swelling was grotesque. His hand was the size and shape of a ripe melon. The fingers stuck stiffly out of the blue ball of flesh. The swelling carried up the forearm to the elbow, trebling the girth of his lower limb, and the skin had burst open, and clear lymph leaked out of the tears. The bite wounds were deep, slimy, yellow pits. The edges flared open like the petals of a flower. And the smell of infection was sweet and thick as oil in Lothar's own nostrils and throat, disgusting him. Above the elbow, the swelling was not so intense, but there were livid scarlet lines beneath the skin, running right up to Lothar's shoulder. He reached up and gently explored the swollen glands in his armpit. They were hard as musket balls buried in his flesh. Gangrene, he told himself. And he realized now that the carbolic acid solution with which he had originally cleansed the bite wounds had aggravated the condition. "Too strong," he muttered. "Too strong solution." It had destroyed the capillary vessels around the wound, preparing the way for the gangrene that had followed. The hand should come off. He faced the fact at last, and for a moment he even considered attempting the operation himself. He imagined starting at the elbow joint and cutting. "I can't do it," he decided. "I can't even think of it. I have to go on as far as the gangrene will let me, for Manny's sake." He looked up at the boy. "I need bandages." He tried to make his voice firm and reassuring, but it came out as a raven's croak, and the boy started and tore his eyes from the ravaged limb. Lothar dusted the suppurating wounds with carbolic crystals, all that he had, and bound them up with strips of blanket. They had used up all their extra clothing for bandages. "How far is she behind us, Henny?" he asked as he knotted the bandage. "We have won time," Hendrik guessed. "They must be saving their horses. But look at ours." One of the animals had lain down at the edge of the water, the sign of capitulation. 5 or 6 hours behind us," he said. And it was 70 miles to the river, with no guarantee that the pursuers would honour the border and not pursue them across. Lothar did not have to voice these doubts. They were all too aware of them. "Manfred," he whispered, "bring the diamonds." The boy placed the canvas haversack beside Lothar, and he unpacked it carefully. There were 28 of the small brown cartridge paper packages with their red wax sealed. Lothar separated them into four piles, 7 packages in each. "Equal shares," he said. "We cannot value each package, so we will cut them four ways and give the youngest first pick." He looked across at Henrik. "Agreed?" Svart Henrik understood that the sharing of the booty was at last an admission that not all of them were going to reach the river. Henrik lowered his eyes from Lothar's face. He and this golden-haired, white-skinned devil had been together since the far-off time of their youth. He had never considered what held them together. He felt a deep, unwavering antagonism and distrust towards all white men except this one. They had dared so much, seen so much, shared so much. He did not think of it as love or as friendship. Yet the thought of the parting which lay just ahead filled him with a devastating despair, as though a little death awaited him. "Agreed," he said in that deep resonant tone, like the chime of a bass bell. And he looked up at the white boy. The man and the boy were one unit in Henrik's mind. What he felt for the father was also for the son. "Choose, Manny," he ordered. "I don't know." Manfred put both hands behind his back, reluctant to touch one of the piles.
"Do it,"
snapped his father, and obediently he reached out and touched the nearest pile.
"Pick them up,"
Lothar ordered, and then looked at the black youth.
"Choose, Klein boy."
There were 2 piles left, and Lothar grinned through cracked lips.
"How old are you, Henny?"
"As old as the burned mountain, as young as the first flower of spring," the Ovambo said, and they both laughed. "If I had a diamond for every time we have laughed together," Henrik thought, "I would be the richest man in the world." And it required an effort to keep the smile on his face. "You must be younger than I am," he spoke aloud, "for I have always had to care for you like a nursemaid. Choose." Lothar shoved his chosen pile across to Manfred.
"Put it in the haversack," he told him.
And Manfred packed their share of the booty into the canvas bag and strapped it closed, while the 2 black men filled the pockets of their tunics with their packages.
"Now fill the water bottles. It's only 70 miles to the river," Lothar said.
When they were ready to leave, Henrik stooped to help Lothar to his feet. But he struck Henrik's hands away irritably and used the trunk of the acacia to push himself upright. One of the horses could not rise, and they left it lying at the water's edge. Another broke down within the first mile, but the other 2 limped on gamely. Neither of them could any longer support the full weight of a man, but one carried the water bottles, and Lothar used the other as a crutch. He staggered along beside it, with his good arm draped over its neck. The other 3 men took it in turns to lead the horses, and they trudged on determinedly northwards. Sometimes Lothar laughed without reason, and sang in a strong, clear voice, carrying the tune so beautifully that Manfred felt a buoyant rush of relief. But then the singing quavered, and his voice broke and cracked. He shouted and raved and pleaded with the fever phantoms that crowded about him, and Manfred ran back to him and circled his waist with a helping arm, and Lothar quieted down.
You are a good boy, Manny, he whispered. You've always been a good boy. We are going to have a wonderful life from now on. A fine school for you. You will become a young gentleman. We'll go to Berlin together. The opera. Oh, Papa, don't talk. Save your strength, Papa. And Lothar subsided once more into an oppressive silence, toiling on mechanically, with his boots dragging and scuffing, and only the labouring horse and his son's strong young arm preventing him from crashing face forward onto the hot Kalahari sands. Far ahead of them, the first of the granite kopjes showed above the sparse, heat-blighted forest. It was round as a pearl, and the smooth rock glowed silver-grey in the sunlight. Santein stopped her horse on the crest of the rise and looked down into the basin of land beyond. She recognized the tall trees, from the top branches of which, many years before, she had glimpsed her first wild African elephant. And a little of the childlike wonder of that moment had remained with her all over that time. Then she saw the water, and all else was forgotten. It was not easy to control the horses once they had smelled it. She had heard of desert travellers dying of thirst at the waterhole when they allowed their cattle and horses to rush ahead and trample the water into thick mud. But Blaine and his sergeant were experienced men and controlled them firmly. As soon as the horses had been watered and picketed, Santein pulled off her boots and waded fully dressed into the pool, ducking under the surface to soak her clothing and her hair and revelling at the chill of the muddy water. At the far end of the pool, Blaine had stripped to his breeches and was knee-deep, scooping water over his head. Santein studied him surreptitiously. It was the first time she had seen him bare-chested, and his body hair was thick and dark and springing, sparkling with water droplets. There was a small black mole below the nipple of his right breast, which, for no good reason, intrigued her. Otherwise his body was without blemish. His skin had the sheen of polished marble, like the Michelangelo statue of David, and his muscles were flat and hard-looking. The sun had stained a dark brown V below his throat, and his arms were brown up to the distinct lines that his shirt sleeves had left. Beyond that, his skin was the pale ivory that she found so attractive that she had to look away from it. As she came up to him, he hurriedly pulled on his shirt again, and the water soaked through it in darker patches. His modesty made her smile. Delarey found no spare horses here, she told him, and he looked puzzled. Are you sure? Gwee says that there were two men waiting here with many horses, but that they left many days ago. He cannot count beyond the 10 fingers on his hand. It was longer than that. Yes, I am sure Lothar de la Rey found no fresh horses. Blaine smoothed his wet hair straight back with both hands. Then my guess is that something has gone wrong with his plans. He would never have used up his horses like that, unless he was expecting to find remounts. Gwee says they have gone ahead on foot. They are leading their remaining horses, and the horses are obviously too weak to carry a man. She broke off, as Gwee called shrilly from the edge of the forest, and she and Blaine hurried over to join him. They are desperate, Blaine said, as they saw the pile of abandoned equipment beneath the acacia tree. Saddles and canned food, blankets and billy cans. He turned over the pile with his feet. They've even dumped ammunition. And, yes, by God, the last of those damned horse irons. The small wooden case lay on its side, with the last few pounds of the vicious iron spikes spilling from it. They have stripped down,
and they're making one last desperate run to reach the river. "Look here, Blaine," Santaine called to him, and he went to her and examined the small pile of soiled bandages that lay at her feet.
"His condition is worsening," Santaine murmured,
but strangely, there was no gloating in her voice, no triumph in her eyes. "I think he is a dying man, Blaine." Unaccountably, he felt the need to commiserate with her, to console her. "If we can get him to a doctor..." He broke off. The impulse was ludicrous. They were hunting a vicious criminal who, Blaine knew, would not hesitate to shoot him down at the first opportunity. "Sergeant Hansmeyer," he called harshly, "see the men fed and the horses watered again before we leave in an hour." He turned back to Santaine and saw with relief that she had rallied.
"An hour is not enough. Let's see we use every minute of it."
They sat together in the shade. Neither of them had eaten much. The heat and their fatigue had destroyed their appetite. Blaine took a cheroot from his leather case and then changed his mind. He slipped it back into the case and dropped the case into the pocket of his tunic. "When I first met you, I thought that you were brilliant and adamant and beautiful as one of your own diamonds," he said.
"And now?" she asked.
"I have seen you weep for maimed horses, and I have sensed in you a deep compassion for a man who has done you cruel injury," he replied. "When we left Calcrand, I was in love with you. I suppose I was in love with you from the first hour I met you. I couldn't help that. But now, I also like you and respect you."
"Is that a different thing from love?" she asked.
"It is a very different thing from being in love," he affirmed. And they were silent for a while before she tried to explain.
"Blaine, I have been alone for a long time, with a small child to protect and to plan for. When I came to this land as a girl, I served a hard, unrelenting apprenticeship in this desert. I learned that there was nobody I could rely upon but myself, no way to survive but through my own strength and determination. That hasn't altered. I still have nobody but myself on whom I can rely. Isn't that so, Blaine?"
"I wish it were not." He did not attempt to avoid her gaze, but looked back at her candidly. "I wish..." He broke off, and she finished the statement for him.
"But you have Isabella and your girls."
He nodded. "Yes. They cannot fend for themselves."
"And I can. Isn't that right, Blaine?"
"Don't be bitter with me, please. I did not seek this. I have never made you any promises."
"I'm sorry." She was immediately contrite. "You are right. You have never promised me anything." She glanced at her watch. "Our little hour is up," she said, and rose in a single lithe movement to her feet.
"I shall just have to go on being strong and hard," she said. "But never tax me with it again, please, Blaine. Never again."
They had been forced to abandon five of their own horses since leaving the waterhole of the Elephant, and Blaine was alternating between walking and riding in an attempt to save the remaining animals. They rode for half an hour, and then dismounted and led for the next half hour. Only the bushmen were unaffected by the thirst and fatigue and heat, and they chafed at the halting and tortuous pace they were forced to adopt. "The only consolation is that Delarey is doing even worse than we are." From the spoor they could read that the fugitives, reduced to a single horse between them, were making even slower progress. And it's still 30 miles or more to the river. Blaine checked his watch. Time to walk again, I'm afraid. Santaine groaned softly as she swung down from the saddle. She ached in every muscle, and the tendons of her hamstrings and calves felt like twisted wire strands. They trudged forward, and every pace required a conscious effort. Santaine's tongue filled her mouth thick and leathery, and the mucous membrane of her throat and nostrils was swollen and painful, so that it was difficult to breathe. She tried to collect her saliva and hold it in her mouth, but it was gummy and sour, serving only to make her thirst more poignant. She had forgotten what it was like to be truly thirsty, and the soft, sloshing sound of the water bottles on the saddle of the horse she was leading became a torment. She could think of nothing but when they would be next allowed to drink. She kept glancing at her wristwatch, convincing herself that it had stopped, that she had forgotten to wind it, that at any moment Blaine would lift his arm to halt the column and they could unscrew the stoppers on the water bottles. Nobody spoke from choice. All orders were terse and monosyllabic, every word an effort. I won't be the first to give in, Santaine decided grimly, and then she was alarmed that the thought had even occurred to her. Nobody will give in. We will catch them before the river, and the river is not far ahead. She found she was focusing only on the earth at her feet, losing interest in her surroundings, and she knew that was a dangerous sign. The first small surrender. She forced herself to look up. Blaine was ahead of her. She had fallen back in those few paces, and she made a huge effort and dragged her horse forward, until she was side by side with him again. Immediately she felt heartened. She had won another victory over her body's frailty. Blaine smiled at her, but she saw that it had cost him an effort also. "Those kopjes are not marked on the map," he said. She had not noticed them, but now she looked up and a mile ahead saw their smooth, bald granite heads raised above the forest. She had never been this far north. It was new territory for her. "I don't think this country has ever been surveyed," she whispered, and then cleared her throat and spoke even more clearly. "Only the river itself has been mapped. We will drink when we reach the foot of the nearest hill," he promised her. "A carrot for the donkey," she murmured, and he grinned. "Think about the river. That is a garden full of carrots." And they relapsed into silence. The bushman led them directly towards the hills. At the base of the granite cone, they found the last of the Lothar de la Rey's horses. It lay on its side, but it lifted its head as they walked up to it. Blaine's mare whickered softly, and the downed animal tried to reply, but the effort was too much. It dropped its head flat against the earth, and its short, hampered breathing raised tiny wisps of dust that swirled around its nostrils. The bushman circled the dying animal, and then conferred excitedly. Kui ran a short way towards the grey side of the kopje and looked up. They all followed his example, staring up the steep, rounded expanse of granite. It was 200 or 300 feet high,